Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Motor Mouth Podcast with me, Tim Sylvie. Today on the show, something slightly different. Our first two-wheel personality. We've always focused on Formula One and other forms of car racing and sports car racing on this show, but today we've gone for motorbikes. We've got Keith Hewin on the show. Keith is a former Grand Prix motorbike rider. He was a commentator with BT Sport, where he was commentating on MotoGP. He's the current host of the OMG MotoGP podcast, which is actually one of our sister shows produced by Motormouth Media. And he's a real motorbike racing enthusiast, knows everybody in the sport, understands the sport completely. So it was fascinating to have a really in-depth chat with Keith about the state of MotoGP and superbikes in general, the commercials behind it, the challenges of diversity and inclusion, and making sure that women are represented in motorbike racing as they're starting to in Formula One. And we draw some comparisons between the two series as well. Really interesting to talk to Keith. Thanks so much to him for his time. I hope you will enjoy it as well. Remember to subscribe and follow us. Leave reviews wherever you listen. It really does make a difference. And enjoy the show. Keith, welcome to the podcast. Now, let's go back in time a little bit. We like to see what's shaped our guests. You were born Southend-on-Sea in 1956. Who was Keith as a youngster? Take us through those early years.
Bit of an adventurous hooligan, I think, would have been the thing there. This seems really weird, someone asking me the questions. It's usually the other way around, especially after all this time.
I like it.
I mean, I had a pretty standard Essex kind of an upbringing, I suppose. My dad was a rascal. My mum was a saint. I was born in a house, not in a hospital, in Westcliff-on-Sea. We moved up the road to a place called Rochford. I went to Hawkwell Holt School, primary school. I think it's still there. King Edmund Comprehensive School, which was a school full of about 1,100 kids back in the day. The demographic, you know, compared with today is amazingly different. But what was a kind of kid was I? Like I said, adventurous. We had the area, of course. You got the seafront at Southend, which is as it is still now, pretty much. Yep. I don't think it's much changed, to be honest. It's still as downmarket as it was back then. But you had such a vast amount of things that you could get on and do as a youngster. Trails. We had just half a mile from the back of my house in Ashingdon, as it turned out. That's where we moved to in the end. Ashingdon, there was a place we called the Brickies, the Brickfields, and it was an old quarry. And you could ride motorbikes around there and do whatever you like. There's a scrapyard on site as well that you could, back in the day, no health and safety, you could wander in, climb over piles of old cars and sort out what you wanted to do, make motorbikes out of them, make cars out of them. We're all driving and riding something at sort of 10, 11, 12 years old back in the day. It was crazy, really, when I think back on it now, because I'd never let my kids bloody get away with anything like that nowadays.
Different time, though, Keith, isn't it? Different time.
Completely different times. I mean, completely different times. You went out of the house first thing in the morning and didn't come back till way after dark. No one was looking after you. I mean, I nearly drowned in the brickfields as it happened, because the old quarry used to fill with water and I couldn't swim. And I remember falling in, and all I could remember was flicking my feet on the bottom when I keep coming up for some air. And my mates holding a big stick out to try and pull me out of the place. And every time I grabbed the stick to be pulled out, they let go of it. And I just took another belly full of bloody dirty water on board. It was just, you know, you'd go out and you'd catch snakes, you go out and catch, you know, lizards and stuff like that that used to be prevalent back in the day then. It was that kind of upbringing. And the first time I rode a motorbike was when I was probably about 10 years old in the back garden, a small back garden. It sounds like a big back garden compared with ours nowadays, Tim, as we've moved on. And it was Ray and Paulie White that had a motorbike that we used to ride around their back garden. That was the first one I ever rode. And of course, on a push bike, I was always the fastest kid on a push bike. I was always somehow the fastest kid. And that moved on to, like I say, riding around the brickfields. And there was a fella called Johnny Ingerfield that I was at school with. And he had a big old 500cc Triumph. I think it was a Tribza, a Triumph, you know, a 500 Triumph engine in a BSA frame from memory. And the first time I rode it, I remember he lent me it for a couple of laps. And I came back and stopped at the edge, and everyone was going, "Oh, you're going to bloody kill yourself. You know, you're riding like a lunatic." And within a few months, he'd killed himself. He'd hit another motorbike coming the other way on the same thing. And ironically, you know, he did. And here I am, like you say, since 1956, still on the planet, even having had this kind of lifestyle.
Well, it sounds like a miracle that you are still alive, Keith, to be honest, from your childhood exploits. But you certainly had an affinity with two wheels. When did things start to move on? You thought, actually, there's a career in this for me, or, you know, I could take this seriously and actually start putting the bikes on the track and racing.
My mum's brother was a speedway rider back in the day. Quite a good middle order speedway rider. At one time, he looked like he could have been sort of somewhere up there world championship wise. But Alan Cowland, for anybody that's really interested, you look him up. He rode for various clubs. Like I say, a jobbing speedway rider, that's how he earned his living. He moved up to Northamptonshire, believe it or not. And my mum and dad followed him with me when I was just about 15 years old. I had a last year at school here because I was the youngest in my year, so it meant that I left school at 15. But so Alan was a speedway rider. I followed him around the country. We had great times, you know. It was fantastic. He was a bit of a hero of mine. Sadly, and for those of you that feel this way, you can look up support, of course. He took his own life later on in life, which was a big disaster from a family point of view, obviously, for us. And sadly, I mean, following on that theme, you know, had any of us suspected or known or considered or thought or made the effort to just take a little bit more notice, we could have, you know, saved the bloke, to be frank with you. So anybody that's in a similar position, that's got a friend or a family member that might be in similar straits, and you were only a guess, it was only a nuance. He just turned up once or twice too often at my house feeling a bit miserable when I never paid enough attention to it. And so I beat myself up for that one. But he was the inspiration for me to go professional racing, purely and simply because you can't be a hooligan. You've got to be a professional. I turned midstream, if you like, around the age of sort of 14, 15, to thinking that this could be a career. But I had to wait because we had no money. You know, my family didn't have money at all. So it was something. Yeah, my mum and dad, basically, they did the best they could for us, which was provide a roof and food and didn't charge me board. Don't forget, back in the day, you paid your parents to live in your parents' house. You know, that was how it was done. I mean, we all bitch and whinge about things nowadays, the way that we have to live as kids. But back then, you had to pay your way, which restricted what you could do in a sports field, if you like. So that was... And I wasn't alone. There were many, many motorbike races. I think, you know, the difference between car racing and bike racing is financial, particularly when you're a youngster. I mean, a lot of the car racing model was always that you took money to the team or you took money into the sport. In our game, we could only take money out of it because we didn't have any to put in it. And that's basically where it all began.
So with all that in mind, Keith, how does one at that era, during that time, at your age, go from, you know, paying your way to put a roof over your head to actually getting on the track for the first time?
It was friends, effectively. I had two friends locally that I met through other friends that were embarking on club racing, which would have been Bill Langley and Steve Trasler. Steve Trasler, I'm still in touch with. Bill Langley moved to America. Sadly, he's gone now. So we don't connect, obviously, because he's elsewhere. But they both had a van, and I bought a secondhand production 500cc Crook Suzuki from a bloke in Luton. And off I trundled to a practice day. We didn't have track days in those days where you could turn up and run what you brung. We had the occasional practice day that was on a Wednesday or wherever it was. And it was Cadwell Park. I went to Cadwell Park for the first time with those two guys, had a buzz around. Again, it's funny how you realize you're fast. You don't know why, but you're running with all the so-called guys that have got all the kit, and you've got no kit at all. I've got a pair of black leathers on that I bought for 15 quid that were too big for me that I had to wear me clothes under just to fill them out. In fact, I remember I sold them back to the same, it's disgusting now I think of it, I sold them back to the same bloke I bought them off. It'd be like wearing someone else's underpants, you know, it's just the worst thing in the world. But anyway, that was how it started. So Cadwell Park on a 500cc Crook Suzuki, I knew I was quick because all the guys with all the gear were behind me. And that's really how it started.
Okay, this is going to sound really naive. Obviously, I'm more of a car person than a bike person. And I've had limited experience with bikes. I took my CBT years ago, so I understand the feeling of it. But at that point in your life, you're turning up at a track, you're going past these guys. How do you know what to do in the sense of, like, you know, taking the apex, or, you know, taking the right line and learning that craft? Or was it like stuff you'd seen in the media or watching it? How did you know what you
were
doing?
There was no media. It's a printed media then. You didn't get it on TV. There was nothing on TV. There's nothing you could look at. You couldn't review a video like most Grand Prix riders do nowadays. They look at other people riding, see if there's anything you can pick up on. Having said that, what you've got to bear in mind, back then it was an inaccurate art. It isn't like it is now. Everybody from club racing, track days forward, are more professional than it was back in that time. I knew I was fast because I could pass people. How did I learn tracks? I remember a friend of mine, Mick Hemmings. Mick Hemmings Motorcycles, he's been a friend of mine for donkey's years. Sadly, he's not with us anymore either. That's what happens when you reach a certain age, Tim. But Mick always used to ask me, what gear are you in at Park Corner at Cadwell Park? And I'd go, I don't know. It was all instinctive. Everything was just, it just came completely naturally. Probably one of the very few regrets I have, because I don't think you can look back over eras and regret the way you did it, because that was the best way you could do it at the time, was that if I was born in a different era, I feel that my talent, and this goes for many of my contemporaries at the time, I feel that my talent could have been stretched much further. You know, I finished sixth in the 350, which is the equivalent of Moto 2 World Championship. In a year, I only did half the rounds. I finished second at the British Grand Prix at Silverstone on a motorbike that we built in the shed, over factory bikes, factory Kawasaki's, you know, factory Yamahas and all the rest of it. Back in the day, you could do that. Now, if you had the right management and the right training and the right people around you back in the day, there were a lot of British guys that were, you know, same as me, and could have gone a lot further. But we didn't have all of that in those days. It was an amateur sport, very much an amateur sport, and it's come on leaps and bounds. Thank heavens for that. And we are where we are now. But I don't regret any of it. Bloody good fun from day one. That's the other thing. We probably have much more fun than they have now.
Well, it's such a serious business now, isn't it? I mean, it's a bit, you know, it's not dissimilar to Formula One in the sense that the technology of the bikes is so high now. You know, the aerodynamics on them is insane, the tires and everything. You mentioned there about, you know, stretching your talent a little bit more. If you could have picked yourself up when, you know, you were, say, 18 years old and popped you in today's British Superbikes or MotoGP or Moto2, how do you think you'd get on?
I have some inkling, you know, like there were... I never had factory bikes that were, you know, a factory bike in my era was 20 or 30 mile an hour faster than the bikes that you could buy over the counter like we did in MotoGP or the equivalent, which was 500cc Grand Prix back then. Don't forget, we were on two strokes then, they're on four strokes now. Lots has changed regarding the technology. I think that if I could say anything about my own talent, I was really good at setup, really good at the nitty-gritty details. The reason we could get the most out of the types of motorcycle that I was riding at the time, even with whatever talent I had, was because we always, they were push starts back in the day, believe it or not. We never had clutch starts. We didn't have launch control and all the rest of it like you got now. But I could go from qualifying on the third row of the grid to leading a Grand Prix. I did it several times into the first few corners because I managed to get my bike carbureting. Now, there's a word you won't hear often nowadays. So perfectly that it would start with one leg lean on the motorbike and it would fire so I could be through. And what I'm saying here is that technically I was quite astute in making the gearing right, making the nitty-gritty of the motorbike. It was just a tad better than everyone else could manage. Convert that to today, and it's the only way that I can, I think we would have done quite well. Because I was analytical. I was one of the early guys that was analytical about motorbikes and about the setup and about what you had to do to achieve it. What we didn't have was any of the kind of backup, you know, nutrition, dehydration. What the hell's dehydration? That probably was something that you had after you'd had a few pints the night before you went racing. And you literally did have a few pints the night before. And you also smoked. I was a 40 a day man between 15 and 28. I gave up completely in 28 and I've never smoked a cigarette or anything since. So it's kind of one of those situations where you're learning through your own experience. Arm pump. I had arm pump all the time. You remember, you know, the carpal tunnel, the muscle inside the carpal tunnel swells to such a point that you lose the feeling in your hands all the time. So what did I do to deal with that? I used to have one of them great big ball clips and all day long I would be walking around with one in each hand and all you're doing is making it worse because we had no knowledge about these things back then. So, you know, it was an amateur sport back in the day. It's come on a long way since then, and it's the better place for it. And I must say that I don't believe in the good old days. That phrase just cheeses me off. And, you know, the fact is we are in the good old days right now. I mean, it's never been more competitive in Moto 3, Moto 2, Moto GP, the three massive classes. Back in my day, you had 80cc, 125cc, 250cc, 350cc, and 500cc as the premier class in Grand Prix. But it was never as good as it is now. Yeah, you had some that were perhaps top three or four maybe, but now you've got the whole grid within a second across all the classes. It's just fantastic Grand Prix racing now. So I'm never going to be someone that looks back and says, they were the days, you know.
Yeah, back in my day, yeah. No, but it's an interesting thing to make that comparison though, because I listened to a podcast recently with Michael Owen, the footballer, and he was saying that, and I think it might have been Shearer or someone who said a similar thing, that the players now in football, in Premier League football now, they're finely tuned athletes. But if you're seriously quick, if you're fast and you can kick a ball a bit, you can probably get to the Premier League. So the actual talent and intricacies of playing football was better back in the, you know, 80s, 90s or whatever. Do you think the talent pool across the different championships is strong? Is there strength in depth, or is there like an elite who are just super amazing and then there's a few also around?
There have been some super elites. We call them aliens. It's something that seems to be a motorcycle thing where we call them aliens, where they seem to do something that no other motorcycle racer has ever seen before. That's what we class as an alien, where the creme de la creme are looking at a guy and thinking, how's he just done that? You know, there are such people. Casey Stoner is particularly my favorite, the Australian that did everything at such a young age. Freddie Spencer was the first alien I'd ever seen in my life. He won the 250 and 500cc Grand Prix championships in 1 year. So that would be like running, in your case, GP2 and Formula One on the same weekend and winning both championships. You know, it's an unheard of feat, and it's never been done since Freddie Spencer, that is. No, the pool is bigger now than it's ever been. It's the biggest, the ladder to MotoGP is tight. The rungs are tight all the way through. Where we're lacking are females We have had our first female world champion in a lower end world championship class, but at the end of the day, and the only reason we don't have females that are there, because the wonderful thing about motorsport, I believe, is that there is no bar to gender at all, in that, you know, the physique and the thinking and all the rest of it, women are absolutely our equal, if not in some respects better than us, may I venture. And the point being is that the only reason we don't have females at the top end of the sport more often is because the pool's small. You know, we're dipping in a very small pool. There's very few females that are encouraged. And I think that goes right back to schools. Schools annoy me. I mean, they're only just catching on that things aren't pink for one half of the school and blue for the other half. You know, they haven't quite got it worked out. You know, one lot don't have dolls and the other lot have motorbikes to push around. It's kind of, the encouragement is only just in very recent times are we equalizing the situation in education as well. I've got four girls, so you can imagine the dinner table conversations. If old dad disappears back into the way of an older fellow, you soon get straightened out in my house, that's for sure.
I'm sure it sounds like it. But is the reason, I mean, it's a complicated subject, I suppose, but in Formula One, if you look at what they're trying to do with F1 Academy and before that W Series, and, you know, teams really investing in diversity, and then going down into karting, I suppose the pool is bigger in four-wheel racing because you can safely or relatively safely go karting at 6 years old. It probably is a little bit more challenging to get on a motorbike or a small motorbike at 6 years old. So the talent pool, I suppose, from a young age is smaller. But is there an argument to say that motorbike racing should be looking at some sort of all women racing championship to try and get more bums into the seats?
Well, we just have, literally, this year, Tim. It's a new thing that it's strange. When you talk to a friend of mine, Jenny Timmoth, who I've done a few broadcasts with, and I think we've done on our partner podcast, OMG podcast, we've had Jenny Timmoth on before. She is a stunt rider in the Mission Impossible franchise with Tom Cruise and the like. She's the fastest woman on a superbike in this country, in the UK. She's quick against all people. She, very humble lady. I just love her manner. But she's not against a single series, but she wants to compete against everybody. And I think the problem we have is if you make these single series, there's a ceiling. They're as good as they are within that group, and there's not the stretch to promote females into a situation where they can then move on into bigger classes, better classes, faster classes, then that's great. But my feeling is that these one make series, these series that you see, they have a ceiling to them, and they don't move on from there. And I think, you know, winning a women's championship, you know, I just don't think motorsport needs that. It may do from a financial point of view and from a sponsorship point of view. That's a different argument. But from a sporting point of view, I think that women are well capable of sticking it to the boys at any given time. So there is a case of a transgender. I mean, Mike Duff, who was a 350 Yamaha, I think it was, rider, factory rider, who was massively fast, you know, at Grand Prix level, obviously did the transition. And it's got a book from way back. You know, Mike Duff is now Michelle Duff. And I did an interview with them a long time ago on I think it was UTV in Northern Ireland. And the whole concept of motorcycle racing, there's no bar. Anybody can join in. It is one of the most diverse, and possibly diverse for anybody that wants to be involved in it. And I think that's great. From a sporting value, there isn't anything like the physique you might have in for swimmers, for instance, or athletes, for instance. This transgender thing is a major problem from that point of view. You know, who has an advantage, who doesn't have an advantage. But in motorsport, nobody has an advantage. We are all equal, quite naturally. And I think
we are all equal. But it's funny because we interviewed Charlie Martin on this show a little while ago, maybe 18 months ago or so. And Charlie, who was a man, is now a woman, went through the change, did it fully, had all her testosterone removed, estrogen put in, you know, fully, she's a woman. And she said that she's a better and more well-rounded racing driver now as a woman with less testosterone and, you know, aggressive traits that sometimes men may have. And she's a smoother, more calculated and quicker driver. But it was interesting that she wasn't allowed into the W series because of her transgender nature. So that she was, I think there was talk of her going in and it just never transpired. And W series was always criticized because of the exact same reason that you have highlighted, that it became a destination, not part of a journey onto something else. And I don't know how you get around that apart from, you know, there's More Than Equal, which has cropped up with Kate Bevan and Coulthard and all that, trying to find a woman world champion.
But I think what you do is, and pardon this, you got to have the balls to do something. You know, you've got to actually get hold of it and say, no, this is the way it should be. It should be our controlling bodies who look after these things and make sure that it, we do not have the same situations that other sports have when it comes to transgender. We don't have that problem, if you like. But there again, it's a small part of the sport. But the point I'm trying to make is motorcycle sport is an equality. It is an equal opportunity sport, whereas other sports perhaps have that bar just purely because it's a physical thing. Whereas for us, you know, you can go from Danny Pedrosa, who's 5'2" and 50 kilos, to Petrucci, who's probably getting on for 85 kilos, I would think. You know, there's a massive difference in strength, height, you know, everything regarding motorcycles. You know, we do have weight limits that obviously try and equal some of that out a little bit. But I think that there is no bar for a woman, and you know, may it get itself sorted out and we have a few more in here. I suspect the biggest bar in any motorsport situation is money.
Yes. Yeah. And is it on that actually, commercially, the commercial side of the sport, what sort of health is that in? Because, you know, you look at, I draw the comparisons of Formula One, and the money in Formula One is just absurd. In fact, in motorsport, the four-wheel motorsport up and down the ladders, you know, you could do a competitive year in karting for £150,000. You know, it's absurd the money that parents are forking out just to get into karting with no guarantee of it going anywhere. What's it like in superbikes? Is it similar? Is it are the numbers ridiculous when you get to the upper echelons?
Yeah, they are ridiculous. You need the backing at the end of the day, and unfortunately, particularly in the UK, you know, the graph starts at a much older age than it does, say, in Spain or Italy, where the weather is nicer, kids are on motorbikes earlier in their lives. You know, there's a bigger infrastructure. It's funny, Stuart Pringle, managing director at Silverstone, I had a long conversation with him when they're building this new kart track that's going to be an international standard and so on and so forth in the middle of Silverstone. We had a conversation. You know, I did a BBC Sounds podcast, BBC Bikes podcast on some time ago with Stuart. And we were talking about this new track that they're building. And I said, so you're going to be running, you know, mini bikes. You're going to be running, you know, the pocket rockets that they do you're running the series that they run in Italy, in Spain, and so on and so forth. He said, you could see he hadn't really thought about, or rather the consortium hadn't really thought about it. And then he said, because we need that. We need that kind of ladder. And as it turns out, no, they're not, because they're all worried about scarring the tarmac for the kart kids and the up and coming car guys. There is no doubt the pecking order is very much car orientated in this country. Jonathan Palmer, you know, a teammate of mine, believe it or not, him in Formula One, me in MotoGP, or the equivalent, which was 500 Grand Prix back in the day. JP, and then JP, we were both sponsored by a building firm in Bedford, SDC Builders, back in the day. And JP and I used to have to do the occasional, you know, meet and greets, handshake things for SDC occasionally. And he now, he's the biggest shareholder in MSVR and owns all the major tracks and the leasehold now on Donington Park as well. So he's got all the major tracks in the UK. You know, I often ask, are you doing enough regarding the ladder? He's got a fantastic series director in a fellow called Stuart Higgs, who is embedded in motorbikes, and he's a real sharp lad. He knows his stuff. But even with that, you know, you wonder whether the ladder is moving us forward far enough and fast enough into the higher echelons. We're behind the Italians. We're behind the Spanish. There are other emerging markets that have come through. You never saw a Japanese rider, even though they produce the best motorbikes, you never saw a Japanese rider at the front of the field. You do now. Now we're getting Asia Pacific riders that are coming through as well from Thailand. We've got some quick riders from Thailand, Indonesia. So we're moving east rather than moving west. There's hardly anything coming out of America anymore. Australia's a dead market as well, which used to be one of the headline markets for motorcycle world champions. So the world is a continually shifting place. And then you bring into the diversification side of things as well. So it's a very exciting place. Dorna, though, the people who own they are the promoters, they own the series, they own Moto Grand Prix, and they also own World Superbikes. They got to inherit that after they bought another load of things through their controlling companies. They're looking to sell. You know, right. They're looking to sell. There's rumors at the moment, £3.5 billion, I think it is, I think 4 billion was the asking price. Yeah, we're talking mega money for someone else to take it over. You know, has it topped out? Are we at the top of things? Don't know. Anyway, we could go on for hours. Yeah, I could go on for hours when we start talking about this stuff.
It is a fascinating subject, and it's interesting to consider whether we are at peak MotoGP or whether this is really just the tip of the iceberg. And I suppose it's getting it out, isn't it, into the young people all around the world who might want to look at a motorbike instead of a go-kart. And that is a massive, massive undertaking, isn't it?
Well, you've just hit a couple of nails on the head there. I mean, like, the fact of the matter is that if you go to any British motorcycle race meeting, you are surrounded by flat caps and grey hair.
Yes.
Which means that our demographic is far too old and encouraging youngsters in there. And if I might touch on the point again on OMG MotoGP, which is Motor Media Production, we've just done a conversation with Brad Binder, a South African fellow who's going pretty damn good, finished fourth in the MotoGP World Championship last year. And he started in karts. You know, him and his brother Darren, who is also a very quick Grand Prix runner, started careers in karts and motocross. And I put it to him, it's the idea to win the MotoGP World Championship and then go to Formula One, because it's been mooted by the likes of, you know, Max Biaggi, if you want to go back to world champions. Valentino Rossi has looked in. In fact, there was a fantastic film, I think it was called The Switch or something, where Lewis Hamilton, who is a quick runner on a superbike as well, by the way, you know, talent, eye to hand, you know, coordination and the like. Lewis Hamilton, quick on a bike. Valentino Rossi, quick in a Formula One car. Talent does cross over, but it hasn't done since the likes of John Surtees, perhaps.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's funny. We've spoken to so many people on this show who, over a certain generation, who actually started like you, tearing around, you know, a field or, you know, some derelict industrial estate on two wheels. I think it was Mark Blundell who was telling us that he did the same. He started out, you know, on little scramble bikes and eventually switched to four wheels. It just seemed the way that things were for the majority of people. But it's really interesting hearing you talk about the sport, and it sounds like there is a real need for it to go more mainstream and attract that younger audience. But that is a huge challenge, and perhaps it needs Dorna to sell up and someone else, you know, like a Liberty Media or someone, to come in and change the landscape. Perhaps it needs to go more digital, like Formula One's done, and Drive Survive and all this, and attract people to the sport.
The people that are in the offing at the moment are connected to Liberty Media. So right. The Fox Warner, Liberty Media type thing. So the Americans are coming, and they've got a chief commercial officer now for Dorna is an American, Dan Rossomondo, who was originally with the NBA, I think, wasn't he? So there are some fairly formidable people that are looking at how this all progresses from now on inwards. Watch this space. It's very interesting. But effectively, it's not as popular as cars. That's where we're at. I mean, Formula One is still, you know, from a commercial point of view, it's top dollar. MotoGP as a sport is more exciting. Formula One as an enterprise is more profitable.
Well, I mean, I think bowls is more exciting than Formula One at the moment.
At the moment, you're right. Yeah,
it needs we need something good to happen at the race this weekend in Jeddah. Now, Keith, we've kept you for long enough. We have a final three questions which we ask all of our guests, and it throws up a myriad of different answers. First one for you, what's got you excited at the moment and doesn't have to be motorsport related?
Do you know what? I live a life of excitement. Even though life is a little slower at the minute, I'm not on the roundabout. I'm not running around the world at MotoGP races anymore. It's family. I mean, it's quite boring. I have to say that my range of children is from 35 to 9 years old. So I don't get any rest around here. And the excitement is seeing them move forward now. Well, you know, one of my daughters has just started at Anglia Ruskin. She's on mechanical engineering. So, you know, we've got, I don't want to be a parent who lives my life, you know, through my children. I think there's too much of that. I have got my own life. Travel is something that excites me all of the time. I can be on an aeroplane for hours. In fact, I remember getting off an aeroplane when I got to Australia once, and the lady at the door, she said, long flight. Are you glad it's over? Something along those lines. I said, no, I could go back. It's the only time I get to read a book or watch the movies I want to do or write anything, because it's the only time you get any peace for sort of 12, 14, 20 hours. Because there's no time in our lives, Tim, where we get any peace.
So true. It's so true. I mean, it's either on a plane. We got a dog last year who's now one. And that's the only thing that's got me away from just the chaos of normal life. It's great. And I listen to a podcast or, you know, just enjoy the countryside and the quiet. It's very rare that you actually are just on your own, you know, no phone, just take yourself away.
Well, nowadays, you can shut the door now. I mean, I love it. You can shut the door.
Yeah. Heaven.
As long as you pay.
Yeah, well, exactly. What's one lesson you have learned through your work and your career that you think everyone should learn at some point in their life?
Listen to others. Arrogance. I'm not against arrogance. I think arrogance is in sportsmen or in business. You need to have an amount of belief in yourself and the way that you're going about something to make it work. So arrogance is not quite the terrible thing that I think that people make it out to be. A degree of arrogance is necessary, in my view, but so is being able to take on board. The smart people that I know have taken on board how other people have done something, what other people are saying, canvassing that opinion to try and work the best strategy out. You know, somebody said to me ages ago, it's much better to learn from other people's mistakes than from your own. Sadly, if you're pushing the boundaries, you're always going to learn from your own mistakes. The unfortunate downside to what I've just said is that with social media being what it is, some of them bullets get through. You know, somebody's probably watching this at the moment, disagrees with what we say, and from a keyboard in Timbuktu is going to give me some stick, you some stick or whatever. I mean, we're old enough to be able to fence that a little bit, but I think sometimes youngsters on social media really take the odd bullet to heart. Even though the silent majority are the ones that probably are the ones that we ought to be listening to but can't because they are silent, it's that those one or two people, and sometimes then bullets get through and sting a bit. So my guidance would always be, you know, if you're getting to that point, turn social media off for a little while. And this goes from a personal point of view outside of sport. If it's getting to you, turn it off for a while. Take a break out of it. Enjoy what Tim's just said. Take the dog for a walk. Just take a bit of time out. Bit of time on your own and work it out from there. But for me, I wish I'd done more listening. What does somebody say? You got two ears and one mouth. That means use these twice as much as this.
Yeah, absolutely. Sound advice. Final one for you, Keith, and we'll let you get on with your day. What are you scared of?
That's changed as I've got older. I was scared of nothing. Absolutely nothing. There was nothing that scared me at all. I've been unfortunate to have witnessed people die. I've been unfortunate to have witnessed massive accidents. And without trying to make out that I'm some kind of hard guy, I'm not. I just had a place to put that. And then it all comes back when you get older. suddenly that side of things, you realize how fragile you are as a human being. And those losses that I've suffered over the years, and there have been many, many of them from friends and family and the like, they start to hit you in the face. I think 50 years old and onwards, you really start to notice it. And then you start to see that fragility, and you worry about, in my case, my children particularly. That's the first and foremost thing. You worry about your children. And for me, that's still my biggest fear, is anything untoward happening to my family. You know, I've done my life. I've had a great life. If it was tomorrow, I fell off my perch, that's good enough for me. I've made sure that I'm insured well enough, so all of my lot are doing pretty well. Business is okay. So I'm okay. But all of my family, including my wife, are much younger than I am. And so therefore, you know, I worry about them. I worry. One of the things, Tim, that I amaze myself at is I can see things happening. I can understand stuff miles away from when it's going to happen. I can predict what's going to happen in one of my children's strategies, one of my, whatever it might be. I can see it happening through my age and the wisdom that brings. I can see stuff. I can predict what somebody's strategy in my house is going to turn out like, where their mistakes are. They can't. And sometimes I said to them the other day at dinner, I said, I'm sorry I get grumpy about it. And I forget that you're only 19 years old, 20 years old, as two of them are. I forget that you haven't had the experience to understand the mistake you're making. So take my advice, listen to what other people have to say and disseminate that. So that's my fear, family, always going to be for all of us, I would imagine.
Very good. Well, Keith, thank you so much for joining us. It's fascinating to hear about your journey through motorbikes, MotoGP, superbikes, and your thoughts on the current state of play in the sport. And some really good advice there for people, which I'm sure will be appreciated. We didn't even touch on the OMG MotoGP podcast. So if you've not had a listen to that yet, go and give it a listen. Keith hosts that with all sorts of interesting guests. And there's Down the Pub as well, isn't there, that you do with some famous names in the boozer.
The only way to go Down the Pub. It's very lucky. It's a friend of mine, a fellow called Chris Herring, who owns the pub. And we get together with some motorcycle personalities, and now OMG MotoGP podcast, we put it out. It's on YouTube as well, so you can actually see us as well as hear us. But it's across all the platforms. Motor Media produced the thing, and thank you very much, Tim, for that.
Pleasure, and thanks for coming on the show, Keith. I will see you soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.